What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, the Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iyerinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detective shaken, to find the Southside Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, the Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, the Scare on Prime Video, now streaming. Get in, losers. This is the Lady Killers, a Feminine Rage podcast. I'm Jen.
I'm Sammy.
I'm Rocco.
And I'm May. Our podcast is a tribute to the female-identifying killers in horror and more.
Each episode will feature us, your Supreme Court of female murderers, discussing our favorite lady killers, from your Julias and Jennifers to your Carries and Christines.
We'll tell her story, decide if it's good for her horror, and answer the most important question of all: would we die for her?
Join us on Thursdays as we pull on our sweaters, snatch our ice picks, sharpen our scissors, and honor the lady killers who live on the silver screen.
No boys were harmed in the making of this podcast.
Yet.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, and welcome to the Bloody Disgusting Network. The passage of time will now bring you to something strange, unique, and idiosyncratic. Have a good time.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you, but if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Hey everyone, Randall here with Mike. Say hello, Mike.
Hey.
Today we're here talking to Bev Vincent, author of the brand new Stephen King, A Complete Exploration of His Work, Life, and Influences. If you're a patron, you've probably heard Bev on the Losers Club before. He was a guest on our very first Archives episode. And yeah, he is truly a King scholar, the author of books like The Dark Tower Companion, the Stephen King Illustrated Companion, The Road to the Dark Tower, and also, you know, a published author of his own stories. Thank you so much for coming back on the Losers Club, Bev.
Thanks very much, guys. Happy to be here with the other losers.
Yes, absolutely. I'd love to hear a little bit more just kind of about the origins of this book. Obviously, you know, you've been writing about King for a lot of your career. So it makes total sense that you'd write sort of a complete exploration kind of book. So what was the impetus for this particular tome, and how would you sort of characterize the writing process?
So in, I guess it was about 2008, I was approached by a publisher who had been commissioned by Barnes & Noble to do a reader's companion to Stephen King. And that's where the Stephen King Illustrated Companion came from. And for that one, it was meant to be a shorter volume, so I didn't have the room to be as expansive as I wanted to be, so I only could cover 8 or 10 books in that one. And over the years, I kept going back to them saying, you know, should we update it? And we did an update once where we added a new chapter at the end. And then last year, I went back to them and found out that the publisher had been acquired by the Quarto Group. So they were now part of a much larger enterprise. Mm. So when I pitched this, an updated version, they said, well, rather than doing an update, let's make a completely new volume.
Yeah.
And so that gave me the opportunity to cover everything. To go right back to the beginning and touch on, but explore, you know, in some depth, every book that he's published over his career. And the sort of the internal motivator in the publisher, because they always have to have a reason, you know, why do we want to, you know, do this book, is because next week is King's 75th birthday. Yeah. And that made just sort of the perfect reason for this book to happen. And so some of the content is what was in the Stephen King Illustrated Companion. But I've gone back and I've looked at everything. I mean, there were books from the 90s that I never even mentioned in that previous book. And now I have an opportunity to dive into them. Plus, with given the increased width, I was able to do things like sidebars on Castle Rock and Derry, and you know, explore some of those things that as deep as I could get into them. And so it's a the title is, you know, the work life and influences of King. And so I've never been particularly interested in straight biography.
Yeah.
Where I'm interested in biography is where it intersects with what he's writing. How does his life influence a particular book that he was working on, or even a story from the past that, you know, sort of crops up into something that he writes subsequently? And so a lot of what I've done in this book is to go back to the horse's mouth, so to speak, and to find interviews that were given around the time books were being written or being published, and, you know, by King, you know, those interviews, and to pull quotes that show where his head was at. Well, what was he thinking? Why did he write these books? All the way up to, I was fortunate to be able to put in at the end an interview he gave about Fairy Tale when it was first announced, so that I could have the Fairy Tale, you know, it's complete up through Fairy Tale, with some of his thoughts on where that story came from.
Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly an insight that we like to try to, you know, target when we're doing our chronological reread on the podcast and going into the book episodes, just kind of seeing like where his head is at the time of writing, and so much of that, how that speaks to the story. You know, having gone through his work so many times throughout your own career while studying him, what were the biggest revelations you would say coming out of this book in that capacity of just, you know, life imitating art imitating life, I would say?
But the funniest revelation I had was when I wrote the sidebar about Castle Rock. And I had it in the back of my mind that I was going to go through all the books and find all the places where details about the geography of Castle Rock were mentioned. And I was going to create a map of Castle Rock. That was going to be my pride and joy. Here's a map of Castle Rock. Only to find out it is not possible.
Yeah.
Because there are so many contradictions over the years. You know, the roads that lead into and out of Castle Rock change. The relative geography of things change. In more recent stories, you know, there's a lot more detail that seems a little bit contradictory. So no can do.
Couldn't do that.
So what I did instead was Glenn Chadbourne had done a really nice sort of an artistic impression of what Castle Rock looks like for Rich Chismar's Gwendy book.
Yeah.
And so we got the permission to do that. Now, on the other hand, Derry is much easier because Derry is actually based primarily on Bangor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the geography there is pretty well established. And, you know, if King goes back to Derry, he can just go back to, in his mind, at least to Bangor, and, you know, what street goes here and what goes there. And so that one's a lot more consistent.
Yeah, you have
Castle Rock's a mess.
Yeah, you have a quote in there from King where he basically says, the map of Castle Rock is in my head.
Or yeah.
I love that. Well, I think what's funny is you talk about, you know, having the space to insert all these sidebars and to go down all these sort of little rabbit holes. And I think that's sort of the fun of being a Stephen King fan. I mean, we're a podcast that is exhaustive and we're 5 years in, and every now and then we stumble upon, like, how did we miss this little rabbit trail? How did we find this little story that we've somehow never heard of despite being so immersed in there? Were there any like moments where you're stumbled upon something and you're just like, Jesus, this too? Like, and you have to sort of
You know, I've been a great archivist over the years. Every interview that I've ever found of him, I've saved.
Yeah.
And there were some early books that collected his earliest interviews. And so I had to go back to those. And I've digitized almost all of that stuff so that I can do searches.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're looking for something that mentions a particular book, then you say, hey, he was really talking about this back then.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff about 1122-63 in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he had the idea for this back when he was, you know, a teacher, essentially. I mean, they sat around, you know, when Kennedy was assassinated, they talked about, you know, what was going on then? And he had this idea, and it obviously meant a lot to him over the years because he ultimately wrote it, but here it pops up again in various different places. One of the, I think it was probably the volume zero of the Dark Tower graphic novels. There's an interview in there and he talks about this idea. And, you know, in Wolves of the Kala, he basically lays out the whole plot of 1122-63, you know, a discussion with Father Callahan. So, yeah, I mean, that sort of stuff, to see how ideas persist.
Yeah.
And, you know, finally the time came when he felt like he was ready to sit down and write it.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because we're actually about to, Wolves of the Kala is our next book that we're talking about in October. And I've already noticed probably three or four times over the last like couple of years, in certain books, there will just be offhand mentions of like the Kennedy assassination and things of that nature. And it's really fun to sort of see like these ideas that persist and they met, because that's the thing about, I think like it's so smart to structure your book around how is King's life influencing his art and vice versa, because there is really a clear link there. This isn't somebody who like he wears a lot of his heart on his sleeve in his books, and you see recurring ideas. You see, you know, things that are clear. Like we have a section on the pod that we do sometimes called King Sites, and it's like moments where we kind of are like, this is King talking rather than the character in a certain moment, because so much of him is so, is woven into his books, I think. Which is, I don't know, so charming to me and something I thoroughly enjoy. Here's a question. When you were writing this, were there any myths about King out there that you sought to clear up?
Interesting question. Probably nothing comes immediately to mind. Mm-hmm. But in my own life, I would say the biggest myth about King is that he's a creepy guy. A lot of people have this perception of him, and he sort of cultivated that in the early years when he did things like the American Express commercial, and you know, lots of his early appearances, and even to this day, you know, he always likes to throw in little things at the end of his public talks where he says, you know, when you're going to go get in your car and go home tonight, be sure to check in the back seat. he has this persona which is beyond Stephen King. It's like the public Stephen King. And I, you know, having, you know, met him and talked with him and, you know, continuing to exchange, he's just a regular guy. He's very cool.
Yeah.
And beyond that, he's just immensely generous.
Yeah.
You know, in my career, but also you see, and when he did his Entertainment Weekly columns, and if you follow him on Twitter, he does so much to help elevate other people, which is, you know, one of the best uses of social media that you could possibly imagine.
Absolutely.
One of the recurring elements and themes that I've seen in a lot of his works, and especially something that you mentioned while discussing The Dead Zone, and even when, you know, he had finished publishing Carrie, is that sort of paranoia creeping up that this could all be a dream. You know, he talks a little bit about this in Hearts in Suspension as well. And I keep thinking of it almost like the, you know, the, well, I guess it became a Twilight Zone short, the occurrence of Owl Creek Bridge, where it's just like, you know, you live this whole thing and then all of a sudden the rug gets pulled up from under you. Why do you think this is like a consistent fear with him? You know, I mean, do you think it's like maybe his form of imposter syndrome? I mean, it just seems like it's something that still creeps up, like, you know, 30, 40 years later.
But I think that, you know, currently, I think he always talked about his biggest fear. You know, we did Flight or Fright, and it was this fear of flying. But
yeah.
Nowadays, he talks about his biggest fear is about losing his mental faculties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not being able to remember things, not being able to recognize people, you know, the Alzheimer's, dementia sort of thing. And for somebody who is creative, that's got to be, you know, one of the worst things that could happen, is that you no longer are in touch with the things that you've relied on. You know, he lives inside his head so much. I mean, these stories just come pouring out of him. And if that well were to dry up and go away, I think it would be one of the worst tragedies you can imagine.
Yeah, and I could see that being a sense of paranoia of just like, I mean, because if I'm him, the way I've looked at it is like, what if those ideas just stop, you know? And because I think so many of the seeds of his stories come from those moments that, you know, when we hear about him, we're like, Jesus, how the hell did he come up with that out of it? You know, I always laugh about, you know, The Shining and how, you know, a holiday visit with his family, he, you know, he spends one more night walking the hallway and then coming back, having a cigarette. And he had the whole novel figured out in his head. And we look at that and we were like, Jesus, like, how the hell is someone able to do that? And I think about that notion, and I imagine that's maybe what he's getting at, is this like the, what if that stops, you know?
And, and I think he explores that. Have you guys read Fairy Tale yet?
I'm halfway through.
Yeah, halfway through for me. Yeah.
Okay, so a little bit about what Fairy Tale is about is how the myths and legends and stories that we know in our world possibly originated in other worlds.
Mm.
A lot of what the main character encounters over there keeps reminding him of, all of the Grimm's fairy tales, mm-hmm.
Jack and the Beanstalk,
the Wizard of Oz, and even like Ray Bradbury things.
Yeah.
And I think one of the sort of postulates of this novel is that maybe there are other worlds, and the things that go on there bleed through, and creative people are particularly sensitive to them, and they adopt those as the things that they write about. And so, you know, he's done a lot of work over the years of trying to explain where stories come from.
Yeah.
As somebody who's a creator of fiction myself, you sometimes marvel at the fact that you sit down at the keyboard one day and you've got a vague notion and you just start typing and the words just happen.
Yeah.
They flow through you, and you get to the end of the session and you say, wow, yeah, I had no idea I was going to write that. Where on earth did that come from?
The idea pool from Lisi's story.
Yeah,
the idea pool. Absolutely.
Yeah. I love it. That's so interesting. And I guess when you talk about like this whole notion of stories having been birthed in other worlds, I think an image I always come back to, and you mentioned this in your book, and you know, I think it's something that's been out there too, is just him finding this box of old paperbacks, you know, in his aunt's attic. And that was an experience very similar to me when I was growing up, where I was in my grandma's basement and I would spend hours going through her bookshelf. And that's how I found King, was she had three King books there that I would kind of obsess over. And I don't know. So I think about these other worlds. I think it's like so much of his literary journey began reading these sci-fi novels and these novels that took place in alternate histories and alternate realities. And a lot of King's early work, like The Long Walk and even The Aftermath, you know, his unpublished manuscript, they take place in these worlds that are so unlike our own. And I think that was something that when he was young, he was kind of strung, I think, because then he would write something like Getting It On / Rage, which is so firmly rooted in our world. But then he also has this mind that travels around the imaginary worlds and everything. And I think that's such a cool image to think of with King, because he's always been so great at mirroring the grounded world with the more fantastical one.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about influences and things that you read early in your life, I started writing fiction seriously when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And that corresponded exactly with when I had first discovered King and I read the stories in Night Shift.
Yeah.
A lot of what I wrote in the early to mid 1980s were very much in the vein of the things that he did then. And, you know, if I hadn't read Night Shift, I'm not sure I would have been inspired to write at all.
Mm. Yeah.
But I was certainly inspired to write what I did back in those days by that book.
It's such an eclectic collection. I mean, I think we had a conversation a few years ago about Gateway King. And I think I've always just thrown that out there as like the best book to throw out for people that are coming into his world, because you really do get to just see all faces of King in that collection for sure. I mean, even with just Last Rung on the Ladder there, you get to see kind of where he's going to go with different seasons and, you know, even the Green Mile. I want to talk about Fairy Tale just a little bit, because there was a great piece in Esquire this week, maybe even dropped yesterday, but they talked, you know, at great lengths about how fantasy is a real, you know, sets King on fire in a way. You know, he kind of digs into some of the more personal meditations of his own life and his own writing. Do you think this is a genre that does light him up particularly? I mean, when you think about like The Dark Tower and even his work with Straub with The Talisman, or do you just think it's writing in general and it just happens to be that fantasy gives him a broader sandbox to work in?
Well, you know, the segment that I quote from his interview about where the story came from, where Fairy Tale came from, you know, we were all in the midst of the COVID lockdown. He wanted to write something happy, something uplifting.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, the image that came to mind wasn't particularly uplifting. It was about this kingdom where things are going to shit.
Yeah.
Everything's falling down. People are falling apart. But that was, I think he's just so visually driven that when these things come into his mind, I don't know that he summons them or if he deliberately sets out to them. I think they just appear. You talk about some of the things like the Green Mile, where that story came from something that he would tell himself every night when he went to bed. You know, every night he'd write the story in his head and he'd write a little bit further and he'd write a little bit further until it got to the point where he had to write the whole thing down.
Yeah.
And where did that come from? Some image. They almost all start from some image. You know, it came from walking over a bridge when he was going to pick up his broken down car from a garage and walking over this bridge and hearing his heels on this bridge and then thinking, you know, the three billy goats Gruff. And that image was the gem of the, you know, 1200 page novel. But that's where it came from. If he hadn't gone for that walk that day,
right,
something different might have inspired him to do it. But it's hard to say.
Yeah, we always, whenever we're, you know, doing our book episodes and digging deep, we always love to find those interviews where he does discuss the single moment, like with From a Buick 8, which we just discussed. We were talking about, you know, him going to this gas station and almost like slipping off, you know, a hill behind the gas station and like, what if I just disappear?
Yeah, could have been the end. The Amelia Earhart mystery.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And then even like Billy Summers, he said it just started from thinking of a man in a ground floor apartment, like looking up through the window at the feet walking by. And it's like, sometimes we laugh at how simplistic sort of the images are, but I think that's like true for a lot of writers, is it does mm-hmm. start in such a simple place. I want to talk a little bit about, because last time we talked, we discussed like sort of gaps in his past that are, you know, fascinating to us. And looking at this companion, we get the sense that you really wanted to like sort of explore his roots and his college years a bit more. Is this an area that you would say you like dwelled on in your research?
Well, you know, the portrait of the artist as the young man.
Yeah.
How did he get his start? What fired him up to write? We're talking about Night Shift. You know, a lot of the stories that are in that collection he wrote while he was a student.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about things like The Aftermath, which he wrote when he was 15 or 16. I mean, clearly always this burning desire to write. And in part, I think, because he lived a fairly solitary childhood and they moved around quite a bit. So, and I grew up in not exactly similar context, but I lived out in the country and there weren't many people around my age. So I read a lot and I lived inside my head. And I think those are things that drive creation if there's at all any talent there.
Mm-hmm.
You make up stories to entertain yourself. You read other people's stories to entertain yourself. But then, you know, you get to college and you have to write things. You know, you go to class and they demand that you write poems. You know, I think he also saw that there was a, you know, when you're in college, you're discovering yourself, but you're also in a bigger world for the first time than you were in high school. And you want to make yourself known, I think. So, mm-hmm. you know, he did lots of things, like he was in theatrical productions and, you know, protests and all that. But he also submitted a lot of things to the campus, you know, literary journals. And
yeah.
Then ultimately became a columnist for the main campus. You know, all things that, you know, you've got ideas you want to express, you want people to hear them, and all of a sudden you've got a channel where those things can happen. And
yeah.
Those were all seminal incidents that mm-hmm. led to him becoming who he is these days, I believe.
Yeah, we have a ongoing series in our archive section where it's like have we done two, Mike, of the garbage trucks?
Yeah.
Like we basically split up the garbage trucks into certain, like, you know, chunks. Eras, and we've been kind of going through them as just a means of, I don't know, like understanding where his head was at. And I think we've really tapped into this really fun discussion around, and this kind of, you know, started around the time we were talking about Hearts in Atlantis and then Hearts in Suspension, the accompanying book with that, you know, great essay about his college years in it, I believe 5-1. And so we've spent a lot of time kind of, I think, poring over his college narrative and his evolution from sort of Goldwater Republican to, you know, sort of paranoid hippie, you know, by the end of college. And then just exploring like that near-death experience he had in almost a car accident, like when he was in college. And Mike mentioned those what ifs, you know, and I think that there's a lot of those there as well. And I think just trying to like understand who he was during that time is is really fun because I think that's where so much of his professional development happened. So I guess I'm curious, like Hearts in Atlantis, do you think like there is something so deeply personal about it? And it's really hard for us as readers to not see King as Pete, the main guy in that book. For you personally, like when you read that and having, you know, the relationship that you have to King, how much of King do you see in that story?
Yeah, quite a bit. Yeah. And he lived in an era where if you didn't go to college, you went to Asia. Mm-hmm. And so this tightrope of, you know, I've got to keep up my academic level or else I'm going to get kicked out of university. If I do that, I could die. Yeah. And, you know, hearing you talk about near-death experiences is something that's sort of triggered in my mind. We should do a discussion sometimes of all the times in his life when he almost died.
Yeah,
seriously.
The other one that came to mind was the story he tells in the introduction to Flight or Fright about the time he was on the plane when he almost collided with a much larger aircraft.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly, I mean, there is a separation between King, the person, and the characters in his stories. I mean, Mike Noonan in A Bag of Bones is not Stephen King. Yeah. But
yeah,
we write from what we know and who we are and what we've experienced. So there's certainly got to be some level of King the person in there. And certainly Pete in Hearts in Atlantis. And you know, the other part of that is Low Men in Yellow Coats. That all took place in places where King lived as a kid.
Yeah.
So Bobby is also an avatar for King.
Yeah.
Growing up in those houses in that location. And, you know, from my own writing, sometimes it's complete and utter fiction. There's nothing to do with you, but more often than not, and I find the more honest things that you write are things that are drawn from something that means a lot to you, from some personal experience, which you then are free to just blow out of proportion. But there's a seed of truth there, which I think readers can identify.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there was maybe a Carol in a circle, maybe in college and maybe growing up that...
Yeah, certainly he had girlfriends before he met Tabitha. Some of them fairly long term.
Yeah,
he hasn't talked about them in any significant detail, but he does mention some of them in Hearts in Suspension.
Yeah,
so very possibly. Yeah,
that era was just so much fun to go through because it really does feel like a Rosetta Stone into so much of his own id and his, you know, his spirit there and how
and just the political landscape of that time too. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean,
what would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, the Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iyerinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detective shaken, to find the Southside Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, the Scare, features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, the Scare on Prime Video, now streaming.
I mean, we mentioned King's garbage truck, but like, where do you feel that, you know, places him in his development as a writer? Like, do you feel like he was really starting to develop his muscles there, or do you think he already had them at that point?
Definitely already had them when you hear about how he wrote those columns.
Yeah.
And he had, you know, 10 column inches or whatever they gave him. He showed up an hour before the deadline, sat down at the typewriter, just click, 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 click away. Filled exactly the right amount of space, told the story, whatever he was going to talk about from beginning to end. There's no question in my mind that he is a natural storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there are many people who can just reel out the stories beginning to end in full, you know, three-act structure or whatever there's just something almost genetic that he's got that allows him to do these things.
He really,
and when you hear about times when he struggles with stories, then you sort of come up against, say, well, it doesn't always work.
Yeah.
We'll never see the plant come to fruition, I believe, just because that story, although it excited him at some point, just ground to a halt and he couldn't chisel it out of the rock the way that he normally can.
It's a fascinating story to discuss. We have a whole episode about it. It's a riot.
And that seems like such a rarity too, because I mean, one of the things we remarked while our last archives episode was all going through 1982 and, you know, a lot of uncollected essays and interviews. But one of the things I gleaned in the interviews, and granted, you know, interviews are sometimes edited, you know, for clarity and, you know, brevity on paper. But I have to imagine, and even watching like when he's on Dick Cavett, you're right. He is such a storyteller at heart and organically, because he'll just pull things in metaphors and stories and to prove his point with such ease. And with you know, so much like there's so much grace to it, where it has a beginning and a middle and ending. And I can't, I mean, it's just in that capacity, I'm so much jealous, because it's so nice to be able to, it's like, I'll start off with the metaphor sometimes and I'll just absolutely catapult with it. And I'm like, where the fuck was I going with this? And like, but he just does it with ease. And it's like, and they really kind of strengthen his point. And I do wonder how much of it is thought ahead of time, or if it's just in the moment with him, you know, or it's just something.
A lot of it has to be in the moment, because when you're in an interview situation, you really never know what somebody's going to throw at you. The other thing that impresses me is his facility with poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not necessarily writing it, but just to casually, in the middle of a conversation, an interview, and in many of his books, just to pull out a snippet of poetry from some random place that is so appropriate. One poem I know that he talked about several times over his career in different interviews, and that's the reason why I suggested it for Flight or Fright, was the Falling that we have at the James Dickey poem. But I mean, I did an essay for the Poetry Foundation about King's poetry, and I got back into the archives and I got copies of even unpublished poems and that. And, you know, they are what they are. But the other side of it was how often he quotes poetry in his novels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's, once you start looking, it's everywhere. There's characters who are poets, like Gard in the Tommyknockers was a poet. And you know, the two old characters in Herman Wauk is Still Alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're two elevated poets who are just sort of sitting down, chewing at each other over poetry. And yeah, it's everywhere. And you know, and Peter Straub, who, you know, sadly passed away recently, started his career as a poet too. He has like three or four books of poetry, and you sort of see that there's a certain mindset. They're different art forms, but you have to wonder if studying poetry as deeply as both of them did, how much that influenced their facility with prose.
Yeah, like I was saying one of the things I appreciated about this book was kind of the time and care you put into discussing King's poetry, because I don't feel like I don't see that in other companions.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, it's not a huge part of his work, but I think one of the things we've discovered on this podcast is we like going into those small little pocket and those little corners of his work. Like, we haven't done a poetry episode yet, but we probably will someday, because I think that there is, you know, a lot to discuss there, even if it's not, you know, his crowning achievements. In your book, you sort of break things up into eras, which, you know, is something we've kind of unwittingly done. Just like, I think it's by the nature of when you do sort of a chronological dive into an author's work, you will inevitably find eras. So for you, how did you, you know, find the breaks? Like, how did you define those eras?
It seemed natural to me that, you know, we look at, and I break it up by the decades, and there's some very clear delineations. I mean, the 1970s were the Doubleday years for the most part.
Yeah.
And, you know, then there's the transition into the 80s when, you know, he has passed the cusp of being, you know, a celebrated writer to being this machine of, you know, bestseller after bestseller after bestseller. And also the rise of the first era of adaptations. You know, 1980 was when The Shining came out. And then from that point on, then, like, people just went crazy over adapting King.
Yeah.
Then you have the sort of late 80s crisis of ending his drug addiction. And so then we go into the 90s with things like the three novels which with female characters, Rose Matter, Dolores Claiborne, Gerald's Game. And so like there's the early 90s section, and then you get toward the end of the 90s and you begin another transition with things with his move to Scribner with Bag of Bones, where all of a sudden he's getting some literary acknowledgement, some critical acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Which had evaded him. And then, of course, the accident is the Sazora at the end of 1999. And then you have this whole new post-accident King that moves on into the 2000s.
That's where we're at now, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, and I think when you get, you know, I don't think it's quite as clear to get from 2000s to the 2010s. But the way I looked at it was, it was the time when he really started to embrace his passion for straight crime fiction.
Yeah, 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 Colorado Kid, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, the Mercedes series and Billy Summers. And so that's a little bit less obvious, but it seemed like a natural bridge since I had done it for the other decades. But yeah, when you think back over his career, it really does seem to be very decade-based. He probably doesn't think about it that way, but from my external point of view, that's the way I thought of it.
Do you think we're done with the true crime era for him? I mean, I know he has Holly coming out next year and all, but it seems as if there's this sort of, because of Gwendy and Fairy Tale, that maybe he is kind of going back to that a little bit more. Like maybe he's a little bit more interested in doing the fantastical. Or, but then again, I mean, he seems, I mean, he just had Later last year. So, I mean,
yeah. And you know, we think of the crime stuff as being more recent, but if you go right back to the beginning, a lot of his early short stories intermixed with the horror are a whole bunch of straight crime stories.
Yeah.
There's things like The Ledge and The Wedding Gig and The Fifth Quarter.
And Strawberries.
And so, and yeah, and I know from my interactions with him that he really loves reading and watching crime.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff we pass back and forth to each other are recommendations for novels and TV series that we know we're going to like. We like the Scandinavian series. We just, he recommended one, he posted on Twitter about it, one called Cleo, which is set in the Berlins in 1990. And I mean, we both eat that stuff up. And, you know, there was a time when he wanted to, when he moved to England, which is where he ended up meeting Peter Straub face to face for the first time, he went there with the idea that he was going to write a British infused cozy or crime mystery. So I don't think we've come to the end of that. I think, and one of the things that I've discovered with my own writing is that I've evolved away from horror for the most part into writing crime fiction, to the point where nowadays when I write a science fiction story or a fantasy or a horror, it's very often a carefully disguised crime story.
Sure. Yeah.
I have one recently, which is set on a space station, but it's really the Maltese Falcon set on a space station. And, you know, what you read so widely influences what you write too. So, yeah, I mean, the fantasy stuff keeps coming back. Sadly, I don't think that we'll ever get back to the territories.
Yeah.
But who knows what he's got? We only know about Holly coming down the pipeline. We do know that there is a novella, which I assume is going to be part of a novella collection called Rattlesnake, which is a Cujo sequel.
Yeah, he broke that news on our podcast.
He just casually threw it out there. Like, oh, you're like, we're not going to care. You know? Oh, yeah, me. Cool.
Yeah, that's also exciting. So, you know, we've been sort of exploring this era between 1998 and 2002. That's kind of where we've been for around the last year, because there's so much to discuss. And obviously, you know, and we're about to move into like the final Dark Tower books and everything. But we spent a lot of time talking about The Accident and a lot of talking about Dreamcatcher and Riding the Bullet and stories like that, that are so clearly indebted and immersed in his recovery. And facing mortality, like knowing that death is coming, like that, those themes are so pervasive in this post-accident work that it was so clearly like a major event for him. One of our listeners actually posed this question, and it's basically, are there any other moment, like things in King's life that you've seen that you think contributed to the shape of his work or the themes of his work as much as the accident has, like to this post-accident work? Like, what other moments in his life do you think have rippled throughout his work?
Well, certainly I think the his experience as an addict has informed a lot of what he's done. I mean, you look at characters like, in The Shining, obviously, Johnny is an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Larry in The Stand has his flirtations with addiction. And even to this day, you've read enough of Fairy Tale to see that here's a man who fell down and severely shattered his leg, ends up in one of those external fixators that King had, becomes addicted to Oxy, and also facing his mortality.
Yeah,
in an interesting way, but he's finally gotten to a point where he understands that he needs to pass the mantle off to somebody else. And it's twofold. He needs somebody to look after his dog, and he needs somebody to look after his secret. And so I think, you know, the face of mortality certainly has to be on his mind. You know, he's coming up on 75, and he knows he's not going to live forever. Having kids would be another thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in law, he wrote so much about kids in his early days, primarily, I think, because he had a whole bunch of them running around, and he had unwilling fodder for material. And now he's got grandkids. He talks about how he, you know, his own children are so grown up that he can't observe them for material anymore. But now he's got the grandkids that he can do that with and ask them questions. And
yeah,
I mean, those are things that kind of immediately to mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess speaking of, you know, that era in 1998, 2002 in the accident, and what you just kind of said about him getting older. And, you know, you have these quotes in the end of the book where, you know, King basically says he'll keep writing until he's done, you know, like, and what's been interesting about doing all this research in this 1998 to 2002 era is that King talks a lot about him not writing and about him retiring. And, and I know that he criticized like some of the media coverage of those comments and disputed them. But the thing is, like, the seeds of it are there. There was this idea of retirement on his mind. And it really, I think it was there before the accident, but exacerbated somewhat post-accident. I guess, like, what insight do you have maybe into, I don't know, what motivated those comments from him and what changed that maybe?
You know, the first time that people started to really think, maybe he's not going to write forever was Bag of Bones. Because Bag of Bones ends with the Bartleby the Scrivener quote. That was a big inspiration for the book about, you know, I'm going to lay down my Scrivener's pen and I prefer not to. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people looked at that and said, oh, that means he's quitting. To the extent that I had people within King's organization, you know, sort of telling me to use my platform at that time, which was the Usenet news groups, to reassure people that's not what he meant. You know, this isn't King writing, this is Mike Noonan. But it really came up when he did his marathon writing of the final three Dark Tower books.
Yeah.
And he spent a lot of time, he wrote 2,500 pages of manuscripts in a very, very short, you know, a year and a half time period. And he was exhausted. And so it's natural that you might feel a little bit burnt out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, he did definitely say to different people, at least as he was quoted, especially in that Los Angeles Times interview, that, you know, I can see the time when, not necessarily that he wouldn't write anymore, but that he wouldn't publish anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he always equivocated about that. He'd say, I will go to my grave writing.
Right.
But this machine of publishing can be exhausting. They ask a lot of him. I mean, he has to go out, you know, less now than in the past, but he always has to, you know, go out and promote the things.
Yeah.
And he has to do interviews. And, you know, for somebody, I mean, I don't know how many interviews he's done in his life, but I'm guessing that it must be in the high hundreds, if not in the thousands.
Yeah.
And after a while, I'm sure he just doesn't want to do it anymore. I mean, I was really honored this idea came up from the International Thriller Writers. You know, they're a very supportive group and they help promote their members. And so they were going to do some coverage of the new book. And the person who was in charge of that project said, well, what do you think about getting Stephen King to interview you?
It's great, yeah.
And they said, you know, we had a similar experience with somebody who's written about Lee Child, and Lee Child interviewed them for their book, and it was very popular. And I was thinking, you know, I've interviewed King a few times, and we interviewed each other once for the audiobook of Flight or Fright, but it was a big ask. I was nervous about asking that. And it was... another demonstration of his generosity that he didn't hesitate. He just said, yeah, absolutely. And we did this interview and it's been, it was, you know, it's great. I mean, my publisher and publicist are beside themselves, but it's just, he is so generous that way. Because you have to think, I mean, there's been other times when people have approached him and sometimes they've filtered through me and say, oh, could we get in touch with King to do this or that, the other thing? And he said, yeah, I'm too busy, or right. I just finished a book and I want to spend some time with my grandkids, or, you know, getting the time right is sometimes a matter of balance. But
I love it.
It was a fun piece. Mike. It was an absolutely fun piece. And I did you have a, was there any anxiety going into it? Like, what is he going to ask?
Not really, because I knew he wasn't going to like drop any bombs. Yeah. So that wouldn't be nice. But yeah, I mean, he asked me the sorts of things that gave me some room to really be expansive about things that maybe I haven't talked about in other places before. Yeah. And
Yeah, I love what you were just saying about like the idea, like the distinction between publishing and writing. And that's something we've talked about on this pod too, because I love, we mentioned The Plant earlier, The Plant, Riding the Bullet, these were attempts to break from traditional publishing. And I think the whole experience that he had, you know, I believe going from Viking to Scribner, like, I know that that was kind of a whole, you know, ordeal. And I think it probably exhausted him. And I think, and so watching over the years, him try to, I think, boost, like, I think about like the true crime stuff that he does and like trying to boost smaller publishers and do work there. And then also try to break from sort of the, and especially now, because he was just in court testifying about the mergers that were happening with Simon and Schuster, I believe. And he, and I love what he said, where he was basically like, this isn't good for writers, you know, all of this monopolization. And I think I have seen from him going back as far as the 90s, all of this concern, I think, about the state of the publishing industry. And as somebody who is really powerful in that industry, it was interesting to see him try to sidestep those kind of things. But even then, like the plant experiment was successful financially, but it still wasn't the solution that maybe he was hoping it would be, you know?
Right. Yeah. He's always been, I think I have a section in this book about King as an innovator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, to do a serial novel.
Yep.
Especially when the first installment comes out and you haven't finished writing the last one.
Yeah.
And that was a wild gamble. And for a brief time, it inspired a lot of other people to do the same thing. Riding the Bullet and The Plant weren't his first digital publications.
Mm-hmm.
When Nightmares and Dreams came out, back in the really primitive internet era, you could FTP into a site and download a little package which lets you read Omni's Last Case.
So, yeah, I think we did read about that, yeah.
And you can get a GIF image of the cover. When the Kindle came out, he thought, what can I do with, what does the Kindle speak to me? How can I do something about the Kindle? And came out of the announcement of the Kindle. He's probably got the world's only pink Kindle. and all along he's been sort of, you know, challenging the status quo, looking at new ways of doing things. And certainly when streaming came along, he leapt into that, you know, to the extent that he could, you know, in collaboration with others, to look at, okay, well, let's see what Hulu can do. Let's see what Apple TV can do.
Yeah.
You know, give them all a crack at it and see where things work. I mean, he posted the other day how delighted he was that Storm of the Century is now available on Hulu. Because, you know, when it came out, it was, you know, must see TV. But then, you know, unless you had the discs or something, it was a challenge to get that. And it was a really creepy, excellent thing.
Yeah, we love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So innovation But, and, you know, another little story. So Richard Chismar, who people know from the Gwendy books, had a started out just as a magazine publisher. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And King sent in, had his agent send in a story. And Rich had a fairly substantial slush pile, and it just went into the slush pile, and he didn't know it was there. And the King's agent calls Rich up one time and says, you know, did you not like Steve's story? And Rich almost has a heart attack going through the pile to try to find this story, which, you know, for a small magazine to be able to publish a King story.
Huge.
Is yeah. huge.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge.
Yeah. I love I
mean,
that.
We, yeah. I mean, one of the real things I love about doing this podcast is that, you know, we all come from research backgrounds. Me particularly, I got my degree in history, and never in a million years thought that my life would lead to just studying the work of Stephen King. But the thing is that there's a, you know, there's a misnomer in saying, oh, well, I just, you know, study the work of Stephen King, because what we've learned while doing this podcast is that he really is a prism for pop culture throughout the last 50 or 60 years. Because, I mean, you know, wherever he goes, that seems to be where trends or some sort of things are happening in pop culture. And usually he's ahead of the curve, as we just discussed. And I think that's so interesting to see, you know, all, you know, now that we're 30, 40 years into his career on the podcast, we really do get to discuss so many, like so much of history that's happened, not only just in, you know, in US history, but in world history as well. And we've kicked around the idea on this show that, you know, King really is the last of his kind, this like blockbuster author. And I think blockbuster author is, it's like kind of it's an understatement on how to call him, because he really just has pervaded every corner of pop culture. And I wondered, like, do you think that was just a sign of the times of which he came in, you know, the crossroads that he was able to enter? Or do you think that's his strength of him as a writer, the genres that he's been able to kind of shift through? Like, what do you think it is about him that's made him, you know, essentially be the walking dude, really, of the last 50 years in pop culture?
Well, you know, an interesting what if scenario is, what if Getting It On, Rage, had been his first published novel?
Yeah.
How different would things have gone from that point onward?
Yeah.
I mean, he was writing horror at the time, definitely, you know, he had all sorts of short stories. But if Rage had been published, and if it had been a successful publication, which is questionable, you know, would it have, it certainly might not have caught fire like Carrie did.
Yeah.
No pun intended. So, I mean, the two things I think that he has that not every other, even best-selling writer has, is the ability to create just immensely imaginative and compelling stories, but more importantly, to populate them with characters that we just fall in love with right from the very beginning. I mean, to bring it, I mean, there's lots of examples I could talk about, but to bring it into, you know, 2022, there's almost 200 pages of Fairy Tale in which all we do is get to know Charlie Reed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which
Charlie
I love.
Charlie McGee Reed, I emphasize. He's Charlie.
Yeah.
McGee.
Yeah, which is so fun.
And in doing that, we're with him for the rest of the journey because we're so invested in the outcome, not only of him, but also of Radar. You know, King's animal characters, you know, sometimes get as much personality as humans do. But I think sometimes that's something that other writers don't succeed as well at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've read thousands of books, and certainly there are a lot of authors who they're must read, you know, as soon as they come out, I'll buy them. But sometimes when I go back and look at a book on the shelf, I might have a vague recollection of what the story is about, or I might have a really good recollection of it, but I can't always pick out in my mind who the characters were. Whereas with King, if you put a shelf of all of his books up there and you pointed to that one, I could tell you probably right down to the secondary and tertiary characters who was in that book and what they were all about and what they did. And yeah. So it's a facility of characterization which is magical.
Yeah.
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 As we kind of like wind down here, I'd love to talk about adaptations just a little bit. We just spent 3 hours on an episode talking about kind of the highs and lows of the last 5 years, which we've dubbed the, you know, sort of Stephen King's cinematic renaissance. And you've obviously been on this roller coaster for a long time. So I'm curious what you make of the last 5 years, sort of twists and turns in terms of adaptations. What's been successful? What hasn't? Do you see another surge coming? Do you think Hollywood perhaps fumbled the energy coming off of It? You know, like, where do you think we are in terms of this era of cinematic adaptations?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is something that we saw back in the early to mid 80s.
Yeah.
Was success breeds duplication, sometimes shoddier work because everybody's trying to capitalize on something that seems like a vein of gold. I mean, the success of part one of It was a lightning bolt that nobody expected.
No. Yeah.
No. And I'm not sure that ultimately it was a great thing for anybody except the studio.
Yeah.
Because then all of a sudden everybody's saying, oh, King's magic again. Let's remake Pet Sematary. Let's remake this. Let's make the 15th chapter of Children of the Corn. and none of those really in the theatrical world have been terribly successful. Now, on the small screen world of streaming, there's been some great things happening. You know, Mike Flanagan has done some terrific work, both in the King world and elsewhere. Dr. Sleep was a disappointment financially, although I don't think it was creatively. I think that was a really solid piece of work, especially given that he had to tread two worlds, the Kubrick world and the King world, to come up with this story. I don't know what's happening with Salem's Lot. We're supposed to be seeing it now. I was communicating with the publicists a couple of months ago to say, you know, are you going to do screenings? And then, you know, it gets bounced to April and then it just disappears off the thing altogether. Does that mean that the studio doesn't have any faith in it, or maybe they're waiting for Halloween, or, you know, who knows? But there's not really much on the horizon right now. I do this essay every year for the Overlook Connections calendar. And the one for 2021, there was all sorts of streaming releases. And in 2022, we have a grand total of one, which is Mr. Harrigan's Phone, which will be out in a couple of months. I mean, it's just thing that just dried up completely. And the other funny thing was, I always say, look ahead. These are the things that have been optioned and people have been attached to them. My whole list at the end of 2021, not a single one of them ever came to anything. And so, and that's always been true. There's always been, you know, 20 things that people talk about, they get the rights to, and maybe they've got a screenwriter and maybe they've got a director and they just sort of fizzle out, you know. Maybe someday we'll see The Talisman now that the Duffer Brothers are attached to it. But there's been so many other ones, like, will we ever see From a Buick Eight? Well, yeah, somebody else is just all fired up about it, but yeah, who knows? And Hollywood has changed its model to, you know, blockbuster mode, where if it's not going to make them $100 million at least, then they're not so interested in it, which I think was where streaming comes in. And, you know, The Talisman, I think, will benefit from that. Because any of the scripts that have been done over the last 40 years have never really captured The Talisman all that well. But, you know, given the space and time of a streaming thing, maybe someday somebody will do The Dark Tower at the length and breadth that it needs to be done.
Yeah, one of our listeners wanted us to ask you, should the Dark Tower series be adapted to the screen again, or is it better to just leave it be at this point, based on the kind of failures of the last couple attempts?
Yeah, I mean, I think Glenn Mazzara probably could have written the hell out of a season of Wizarding Glass.
We would have loved it. We loved the pilot. We saw it, and it's we're sad it didn't work out.
Incredibly sad.
So, yeah, and I mean, Ron Howard and Akiva Goldsman had a really interesting approach when they originally got the rights. They were going to do several movies, and then in between they were going to do streaming series, you know, epic stuff at the big screen and more personal stuff at the streaming level. And they had an interesting, I mean, they sat down and they remapped out the series. They had a room full of index cards on the floor where they had sort of taken bits from here and bits from there and put it together into a more linear fashion, whether somebody's got the gumption to do that again, because it's a big project, you know. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of words it is, and how many, you know, set pieces, and how you tell it to make it accessible to people who haven't necessarily read the book.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that they struggled with the 2017 movie. You know, you put Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey in something and people are going to show up. You got to write a movie for them, even if they've never even read a Stephen King book.
Yeah.
So there's that sort of struggle.
It's a tough puzzle. You know, it's a tough puzzle to solve. I mean, the thing that's so astounding to me is that, you know, it, we were trying to discuss, like, was it the biggest adaptation that's ever happened, even beyond the finances, just pop culture wise, like in the cultural consciousness? And the only other film I could think of that really connected on that level, especially with youth, was like maybe Carrie, in terms of just influencing the sort of zeitgeist or capturing the zeitgeist, but also really kind of bleeding and permeating into the tenets of that youth. Like when we think of high school, now we think of Carrie. When we think of, you know, growing up, obviously, we've thought about Stand By Me before, but I think a lot of kids going forward are going to be thinking of it. And for me, it was really exciting also because, you know, not only are you getting a lot of generations that are now coming in and reading Stephen King, but one of the things that I was hopeful with this renaissance was that we're going to start getting people that, you know, filmmakers that, and especially something that, this is something that Randall has written about, it's something that, you know, we were going to get filmmakers that grew up with King that were going to start, you know, maybe adapting their favorite stories. And we started getting that, you know, like getting Gerald's Game in 1922 and even, I mean, obviously even getting something as new as like Dr. Sleep. It was exciting to see some of these newer stories get their first adaptations. And I just, and I wonder, I just think Hollywood got in the way of just being like, all right, well, we got to do the big IP once and we have to redo this again and again. And I do really think that the fumbling the stand is what really kind of just put it to the ground, was that like that was your chance to kind of match the level of it, and I just don't think that they were able to do it. And
and if you're going to remake something that was written for the screen by Stephen King,
right,
you really need to bring your A game to it.
Yeah.
And for me, the best thing about that series, the remake, was the final episode where, once again, you know, Stephen King brings something new to it.
Yeah.
The rest of it was, you know, it was okay for what it was, but it was nothing, they didn't bring anything new to it.
No. Exactly. Yeah, that was our big issue.
It's you know, Salem's Lot is something which I think is really ripe for a good feature.
Yeah.
Because there's been two night miniseries of it. And the original one at the time was fantastic.
I
watched it when it came out, and there are scenes in that that live on to this day. It's hard to go back and watch it now because it's of its era and it's, you know, campy a little bit here and there.
Sure.
The second version I just don't have much use for. I thought they just really changed it to an extent that I didn't even like Ben Mears right from the get-go. So I thought, here's an opportunity to take something which is, you know, it's a manageable story. It's not a, you know, 800 page book, you know, really could do something with it. And I'm hoping, because there has been news that they've been doing some reshoots.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think that they've scrapped it, but I'm hoping that this will be the Salem's Lot that we've all been living with. I mean, I read it in 1979. That story is.
Yeah, I know that's an important one for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. As we wrap up here, I want to do a quick little lightning round with you, because I don't think we've had a chance to do this with you yet. And basically just ask you, of the King books, which ones are your favorites? And so I'm going to start with favorite book. And then I have several of these. So just a little lightning round. Favorite King book.
Favorite King book, Salem's Lot.
Nice. Scariest King book.
Pet Sematary.
All right. Ooh. Grossest King book.
Dreamcatcher.
Absolutely. Is there a King book that you would say you've reread the most?
Probably either The Stand or It.
Yeah. How about a King book you could never read again?
Tommyknockers and Needful Things.
Why Needful Things?
I hated everybody.
See, I love Needful Things. It's like my favorite.
Yeah, and King is sort of disappointed about the reaction to it, but there's absolutely nobody other than the sheriff and his
love
girlfriend.
Penguin.
There's nobody in that book I like.
It is a rough crowd for sure. How about like favorite villain in all of the King world?
Favorite villain? Well, you know, there's some obvious ones. You know, Randall Flagg and Pennywise. Mm. I guess I'll just have to go for Randall Flagg because he was the most inept villain.
Yeah.
He never really was as good as he thought he was.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I love your discussion about King villains too and evil in your book, like where you talk about the idea of King's vision of evil being powerful but stupid. And that's something I talk about a lot on this show is the various ways in which evil is powerful, but it's always like whatever institutions build up around the sense of evil, there's always kind of structural problems. Like it all begins to collapse, you know, because it's kind of a like only like raw villainy or whatever can only get you so far. The infrastructure of the villain, there's always this sense that it's crumbling. I mean, you get that in The Stand, you get that in It, you get that in even like The Institute, which came out, you know, they talk so much about The Institute being this like crumbling building, which I, you know, and I find that such a fascinating recurring theme with King.
So. And Under the Dome, of course, you know,
Under the Dome,
little thiefdom, and his big fear is that he'll lose his controlled environment and then everybody will find out, you know, what a humbug he really is.
And he always wires that in with like religiosity too, where it's has a religious element that gets corrupted, which I love so much about, you know, that mistrust for sure.
Just like crumbling institutions, which I think is very resonant. Just, you know, if we talk about the kind of prism that he is into culture, I think that we've seen crumbling institutions become more and more of a thing within our culture. And I think King is very attuned to that. Last one, favorite adaptation.
Favorite adaptation.
And you can throw out a few if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked what they did with the Mercedes books.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
They added things to it. You know, having his next door neighbor brought in was a really nice touch. It gave him somebody to talk to, which is something that they also did in 11/22/63. They gave the main character a sidekick.
Yeah.
But so much of that thing is internal, that he needed somebody to, you know, tell the audience rather than just, you know, doing an internal monologue. Oh God, there's been so many, but, yeah, I do like the Shining miniseries to a certain point. It's not quite what I, you know, it's not quite the blockbuster that it could have been. But I mean, Gerald's Game.
It's really good.
There's so many. There's
What's a book that you're still waiting on pins and needles to get adapted?
Duma Key.
Yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet.
The audiobook of that one is fantastic. John Slattery, the guy from Mad Men, is the reader. And there's a certain sardonic tone to that character, and Slattery just really gets it. Another adaptation that I talk about quite a bit is Dolores Claiborne.
And
for me, it's an example of something where you tear the book to pieces, reassemble it so that it's almost not recognizable, and yet you capture the whole novel.
Cool. Last question, Mike, do you want to do this?
Yeah, so we're going to Bangor in a few weeks, and I wondered if you had any spots that you'd recommend that are maybe a little off the beaten trail, maybe not, you know, the ones that are the obvious ones, so to speak.
Yeah, the place where we had dinner before the where Flight or Fright was born, before we went to see the world premiere of The Dark Tower, unfortunately isn't there anymore. It was Nick's Cruisin' Diner, and it was a nice 50s thing, but it's closed.
I read about that. I was so bummed out to see that it was gone.
I mean, just walk around the downtown.
Yeah.
The downtown is nice and historic. I think Gerald Summers still has his bookstore there, although he sometimes closes. And that's a place where you can go in and see some really cool shit.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's got props and things, and
I'm gonna lose so much money going on this trip. No, it's just just all gone.
You know, take a spin up around Orono, which is, you know, just a couple of miles out of town. That's where his archives used to be, but you'll see the campus where he attended university. Now, I spent so much time in Bangor as a kid because I grew up in New Brunswick in Eastern Canada. And we just went there on camping trips and shopping trips. And so I'm really sort of familiar. I know where the campgrounds were. I don't know if they still are there anymore, but we camped in the, I think it was the Herman campground on the Hammond Street exit or vice versa. I can't remember which it was, but yeah, I spent a lot of time there. It's a very small town. It's cozy.
I can't wait. Yeah, we're very excited. We're very, very excited.
Well, thank you so much, Bev, for your time. This has been really lovely talking to you. The book is Stephen King, A Complete Exploration of His Work, Life, and Influences. It's now available, I assume, wherever you can get books. But
absolutely.
Is there
a worldwide, which is
worldwide.
Really nice.
That's awesome.
The previous campaign was a Barnes & Noble exclusive, which was a bit of a bummer in the fact that people couldn't get it. But yeah, this one, people can buy it in Argentina or Fiji or wherever they are.
Yeah, and I'd highly recommend the physical version. It's a great coffee table book. It's beautiful, filled with color, filled with photos, archival things. It's great. And anything else you want to plug, Bev?
Nothing that comes to mind immediately. The most recent fiction publication of any substance I had was a book called Dissonant Harmonies that Brian Keene and I put together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my longest published fiction to date. I have a novella in it called The Dead of Winter. We had fun doing that because we made each other a playlist for the other author to listen to while we each wrote our independent novellas. So that's a fun thing. And it was published originally by Cemetery Dance. There's a print and a digital version, and highly recommend it. It makes a great Christmas present.
We'll see. Love it. We'll see. Great. Well, thanks so much, Bev. Hopefully we'll get you back on the pod again soon.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Anytime.
Have a good one. I got some hot friends.
This is the end of our show, for now. Tune in next week. If you like our programming, consider searching for other bloody disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, and more.
What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology coming to Prime Video on April 25th. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s with the city on the edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorinde returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Don Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detectives shaken, to find the South Side Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, The Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, The Scare on Prime Video, premiering on April 25th.